annual World Peace Earth Day celebration, Thursday, April 23rd, from 6:30 to 10:30 p.m. A conscious community gathering with 7 world leaders having a panel discussion. There will be indigenous ceremonies, live performances, and community participation. That's Thursday, April 23rd from 6:30 to 10:30 p.m. at St. John's Lutheran Church, 81 Christopher Street near 7th Avenue. Doors open at 6 p.m. with a 6:30 pre-show. For tickets and info, go to www.planetheart.org. That's www.planetheart.org. Or email info@planetheart.org. Come on down.
Yosef Alfredo Antonio Ben Jokinen, Dr. Ben, as he was affectionately known by those who loved him for his African-centered understanding of Black history, returned to the ancestors on March 19, 2015. He will be missed but never forgotten.
Homegoing services for Dr. Ben are as follows. Thursday, April 9th, from 4 p.m. to 8 p.m., the wake and viewing at the Abyssinian Baptist Church, located at 132 West 138th Street, between Lenox and 7th Avenues. Friday, April the 10th, from 9:30 a.m. to 12 p.m., the funeral services and the opening of the mouth ceremony, also at the Abyssinian Baptist Church. The repast will start at 2 p.m. at the National Black Theater in Harlem, located at 2031 5th Avenue, between 125th and 126th Street.
This is Travis Morales with the Stop Mass Incarceration Network. Tuesday, April 14th, National Shutdown Day to Stop Murder by Police. Stop business as usual. Walk out of school. Walk out of work. April 14th, Union Square, 2 p.m. The murder of Black and brown people by the police must stop. April 14th, justice for all the victims of brutal murdering police. April 14th, indict, convict, and send the killer cops to jail. The whole damn system is guilty as hell. April 14th, call 929-249-7996, 929-249-7996. Go to stopmassincarceration.net, stopmassincarceration.net. Stop business as usual. Stop murder by police. All out for April 14th, 2 p.m., Union Square. National shutdown day to stop murder by police. Tuesday, April 14th, 2 p.m., Union Square.
To the next episode of EcoLogic as Ken Gale discusses the Hudson River, Indian Point, and the intersection of music and activism with Peter Gross and Mana Joe Green of Friends of Clearwater. That's Tuesday, April 14th at 8 p.m. right here on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org.
Way down, way down.
Up lays the river where old mill run. Meet the lazy river with the noonday sun.
Hi, everyone. Juliana Forlano here from the Juliana Forlano Show on WBAI in New York City. Hey, what are you doing the weekend of May 29th, 2015? I know where I'll be, at the Left Forum. Have you been? If not, you're missing the most powerful, transformational conversations of the year.
You're here, I can see your eyes sparkling because you're on fire, not just for justice, but we're talking about revolution.
If you don't give us reform, you will get revolution.
Oh, yes, we embrace the reformers, those who want to tinker, okay, if you want to be incremental, fine, but just don't stop there. We're calling for fundamental transformation of American capitalist society.
When was the last time you got to hear people talking like this?
Capitalism and democracy are not synonymous. They've been on opposite sides of each other since the advent of the Republic.
Come add your voice to these powerful discussions. Left Forum, May 29th through the 31st at the John Jay College of Criminal Justice in New York City. For more information, go to leftforum.org.
My name's Chris Hedges. I'm the author with the cartoonist Joe Sacco of Days of Destruction, Days of Revolt. And when Joe and I are in New York, we always listen to WBAI 99.5 or WBAI.org because we want to stay informed and not get fed the commercial lies of the corporate media.
The work we've done.
This
This is Dred Scott Keys. Join Bernard White and Herb Boyd this Thursday, April 9th at 7 p.m. for a live broadcast from the historic Mother AME Zion Church in Harlem of the opening session of the International Reparations Summit. WBAI will also broadcast the closing plenary session live from the First AME Zion Church in Brooklyn, Saturday, April 11th at 7 p.m. The conference brings together representatives from the Caribbean, South America, Europe, the United States, and Africa to address the issue of reparations for the African diaspora. That's Thursday, April 9th, and Saturday, April 11th at 7 p.m., a live broadcast of the Reparations Summit being held in New York City, April 9th through the 11th.
And you're listening to WBAI in New York, 99.5 FM, WBAI.org. Stay tuned for Earth at Midnight.
Good evening. This is Earth at Midnight with Kathy Davis and me, Paulette Spencer. And I hope that you're enjoying our fine drizzle this evening. Hopefully it will be your real spring weather soon. I'm here with Kathy, and we are happy to have this free-form radio. And as we're settling into the studio, we will start to get into our topic for this evening. But in the meantime, I'd like to call your attention to a concert that is going to be taking place next Tuesday, the 14th of April, and it will be by a pianist and composer, Mr. Roy Jennings, who was one of the musicians featured at Robert Knight's tribute two Saturdays ago. Mr. Jennings will be performing his original work with vocal accompaniment at the St. Paul's Chapel at Columbia University on April 14th. It starts at 6 p.m. The address is 1160 Amsterdam Avenue near 116th Street, and it is a free concert and open to the public.
And I'm sure it's going to be a beautiful event as he plays beautifully, Roy Jennings. And so I want to say hello as well and welcome you all to Earth at Midnight, and hello, Paulette. And I just want to let those of you who are heading for the trains to know there are delays. In fact, I think there was no 7th Avenue line, as far as I could tell, working through making its way from Brooklyn to Manhattan, or for that matter, from Lower Manhattan to Upper Manhattan. So I would advise you go to the A train, or perhaps the Lexington Avenue train, or take a bus or take a taxi. Or, you know, there's one nice thing about it. There's a sense of togetherness, you know, everybody moving through the same situation together, kind of like everything else in the world. But it was remarkable in the sense that nobody seemed that upset. I think people are getting to the point of like, oh, well, you know, at least it's not freezing. You know, it's like you have to count your blessings where you can find them. And so in that regard, it was interesting because people were actually, I mean, if somebody were trying to get people upset and all riled up, this would have been a situation to do it. But it didn't work. At least I didn't witness anything. Maybe it's because I wasn't looking for it, but it seemed pretty calm to me. Anyway, so our opening theme is Michele Indiocello, and the song is called Earth. And now we're going to play Voices from Another Planet, and it's Cyber Tribe. So we go from Earth to another planet. Thank you. Again, you're listening to WBAI 99.5 in New York, 99.5 FM in New York. I'm Catherine in here in the studio with Paulette, and you're listening to Earth at Midnight. And this is an interim program, but we will continue to be here for some time, I do believe, in the future, that is. So I hope you are getting comfortable with our voices during this time slot, because I don't know, I'm a little bit scrambled. You know, I said I wasn't upset about being stuck on the train, but I think my brain scrambled might be why I wasn't upset. I've been giving a lot of thought to really the energies and the relationships that people have with each other. And so that's why I was like really into paying attention to how people were responding. And I've noticed a lot lately in my just general travels that people are really very calm and positive. And I'm not sure if that's actually a universal thing or if it's just something I'm experiencing, because from my understanding, it's what you sort of generate is what you get back. So if you walk around and are in fear of something happening, you're much more likely to attract that thing. If you're walking around in in a poverty mentality, you're much more likely to attract that, you know, based on the law of attraction. So I don't know if the world is actually getting better on in a universal scale, but I suspect that it is. Have you noticed anything in your general experiences in the world that would suggest that things are better than they were maybe 2 years ago or 5 years ago? I know politics are not better necessarily, but just human relations.
Well, I don't feel comfortable speaking on a broader scale because I'm somewhat aware of what's happening overseas these days. So I don't know if they would share my opinion, but
they might
within my own.
Yeah, that's all we can
slice,
do.
Slice of the pie.
Yeah,
I think that there are people that are genuinely kind. You know, you meet people who go out of their way in a nice way to acknowledge you, you know, mm-hmm. on the street, nothing intrusive. And there's a general sense of support of those people who you may not even know. And so it's a beautiful thing. And it's I especially notice sometimes fathers with their children, like with their little kids. Mm-hmm. And when you see a father who's really affectionate with their child, it's beautiful to just watch. And I sort of take pleasure in saying to the guy, you know, walking up to him and saying, you know, you're a great dad. And you mm-hmm. see the smile on the guy's face. It's lovely.
Mm-hmm. And that's something I didn't see much of when I was growing up.
I didn't either.
Yeah, it's kind of a new thing. I see a lot of, and really, really young men with their children, mm-hmm. you know, because you are accustomed to seeing really, really young women and their children. But now, you're right, I see a lot of very young men who are doing very good jobs of parenting.
Definitely. You know?
And it's interesting because it's not something that is you know, based on economics. I mean, I'm seeing this in all manner of neighborhoods and economic groups, and it's, you're right, that's a really beautiful thing, and I see a lot of it these days.
Yeah, it's lovely to see this sort of, I don't know if I'd say new generation, but since we didn't really observe that when we were growing up, me in the South Bronx, mm-hmm. It's lovely to see that what could otherwise have been an unfortunate pattern is shifting.
Yeah.
So you're having these kids with the strong bonds to their fathers, and then makes you wonder what they're going to be like as adults.
Yeah, they'll probably be a lot stronger, yeah. I would think. I think it makes a real difference to have a bond with one's father.
Definitely.
It really does. And especially, well, I don't know if it's, you know, different for boys or girls. I think both children, either boy or girl, need that bond with both parents. And so it's nice to see that, and it's nice to see this relationship with men and their children. You know, it's interesting, when I was a child, you know, as I look at parents now, I always look at them from the perspective of, you don't really look like much more than a child yourself, you know, in my mind. And from the perspective of having all that responsibility and, you know, raising up another life, it just seems like a real challenge for some of the parents who were really quite young. But then I reckoned back to my own childhood, and I had really young parents as well. Because, you know, for the same reasons, I guess, actually, parents are young now. But, well, when I was born, you know, my parents were 18, which is reasonably young, but not that young. Mm-hmm. When my older brother was born, my parents were 15. So they started out very, very young,
okay,
having kids. And so, and I can remember when I was a child, thinking of them as full-fledged adults, it never occurred to me that they were young people, because they looked old enough to me. And so it's kind of interesting. But what's really nice about having young parents is that you are close enough in age to have fun. And I can remember going out into the snow and playing with my mother out in the snow, and you know, we would be, you know, making, you know, shapes in the snow and building stuff in the snow, and so we had a lot of fun playing. And in retrospect, I realize it's because my mother was really young comparative to the ages of her children. It makes it's interesting.
Yeah, I sort of had the opposite, and I'm an only child. And my parents were older when mm-hmm. I was born. My mom was in her mid-30s, and my father was close to 50.
Mm.
My mom would play with me a lot. There would be times when she wouldn't want to leave the apartment, and I was bent on going to a park and having a picnic somewhere. So she would pull out a blanket and put it on the carpet.
Okay.
That was our picnic. But I always remember
cool.
that very sweet kind mm-hmm. of gesture to please me as a child.
Well, that's lovely, and you know, that just goes to show how important it is to have that bonding and that loving experiences. Because I was relating it to the fact that my parents were young, that they liked to play. But maybe, I guess you're right. It doesn't really matter what age your parents are, as long as they're giving you that bonding experience, that loving experience. You go through life feeling like, you know, you have a level of inner confidence, I think, and inner strength when you have parents who have a capacity to support you as a child, your development as a child. I think it makes a significant difference. And that's part of what's been wrong for, we've had a whole lost generation due to all kinds of social issues and addictions and, you know, all kinds of things, you know, AIDS and crack and all these social issues have sort of destroyed a lot of families, and children have been lost in many ways to foster care, to the streets, to crime. So you're right, there just seems to be some kind of turning around.
Yes.
And I actually have one of my nieces has two young children, a seven-year-old, and she recently had a little girl, recently, at least a year and a half ago, I guess now, maybe even two. And she went through all these problems, you know, conflict with the parents, running away from home, living in the streets as a homeless teen. And so she went through all of these struggles, you know, trying to figure out how to get from one stage of her life to the next. And I could remember when she was so unhappy as a, I think, 9-10 year old. She was already talking about suicide at that age.
Oh my.
And so, you know, I spent a lot of time with her, and, you know, she managed to pull through it all. I'm not, you know, she had all kinds of intervention and support, but there was just so many years of difficulty that she had. And then, you know, somehow she came out on the other side like this really together, spiritual, strong person. And she's like so tender with her children. And so, and it's really interesting that she went into this spiral but managed to work her way out of it and is really focused on being a parent. And so I found that really interesting because her parents, my sibling and his spouse, had drug issues. You know, I think he's been on Narcotics Anonymous for maybe 10 years now. But when they were little, both of her parents were addicted to drugs. And one of the children was actually born in prison because their mother was in prison. And they lost the child. The child died as well. So she went through a lot of struggles. And then all of a sudden, you know, she was able to, she found that strength inside of her to transform her life. I think the children had a lot to do with it.
And perhaps somewhere in her development, there might have been someone in her life, maybe you, who was sort of a protective factor, because from what I learn is that people who grow up in a very traumatic kind of setting, sometimes unless they have that person who was there to kind of recognize them, you know, in their individuality, mm-hmm. to nurture them, someone who they can trust despite all the turmoil, they connect at that level, and you sort of awaken this essence in a person, mm-hmm. whereas there are people who go through those similar settings who don't have that interaction. And even in the case of mothers and children, they find that women who've never had that protective factor mm. have a difficulty even saying to their child, I love you.
Mm.
And so those things in life make a huge difference. It's sort of like having a mentor.
Mm. Well, that does make a lot of sense. That does make a lot of sense. And, well, if that's the case, I'm grateful for that, at least to have played a small part in that. You know, I think it's difficult. I grew up in a very loving family, but there were so many issues with, you know, poverty and illness. So there were a lot of issues that fed into all of this. And it really brings up an interesting question when we can think about how it might be possible to make a difference in someone else's life. You know, that maybe you don't have to do, you know, a yeoman's intervention. You just do what you can and hope in what you can do can make a difference, I think.
Certainly. And encouraging someone, sitting and hearing, listening to their story and being there for them, you know, not necessarily, as you say, sort of bending over backwards and doing, you know, gymnastics for them, but in terms of just that interaction,
yeah,
sometimes enough is enough. Your presence.
Yeah, because you can't always solve people's problems for them.
No.
But and I think that this is true in many kinds of relationships where people feel that somehow friendship is I do stuff for you, you do stuff for me, we share stuff, we, you know, and it's not a question of you know, being there to sort of witness the person's essence and to support the person, or even, like you said, to listen to a person. Because I think that this conversation or this realization kind of translates into any kind of relationship.
I agree.
You know, it's probably what makes real friendship is when you have a situation where you really feel like you can be yourself with that person and they don't have to rescue you. You don't have to rescue them. Mm-hmm. But, you know, just to be able to say, you know, this is what's happening or this is what we're going through. And you could just be a supportive person. And I think sometimes the best thing you could do for a person is to remind them how precious they are as beings. Because sometimes people can get really down on themselves. And when we can remind them how special they are, I think everyone is special, but everyone has their own unique flavor of it. And people just get lost from who they are and think that they're not good enough.
I agree.
Yeah.
I agree. And there's so many things that can happen in your way you perceive yourself in your earliest years of development that can influence your self-image. And it's funny how perhaps in retrospect as an older person you look back and think, well, you know, look at all the things, you know, that you, a person, had going for them. And throughout the whole journey, they thought, you know, completely opposite image of themselves.
Mm-hmm.
You know, for whatever reasons, you know, there you can have maybe parents who weren't supportive, maybe you had students at school, you know, fellow classmates who were maybe a bit abusive, so mm-hmm. it could be many things, and that it's what goes in your head gets programmed in your head. And hopefully at some point in your life, if you go beyond that, you can look back and say, my goodness, you know, it's not the way that I thought of myself, you know, at an earlier age.
Right. And that lasts into adulthood and sometimes all the way to the grave.
Yeah.
But, you know, what's really interesting about that is I think that this is the way that we can really be good to each other just as human beings.
I agree completely.
Is to be able to let people know that they are valued, and also not to contribute to the programming. Because I find that what happens sometimes is a person will be in a certain frame of mind, and they're almost like an actor on a stage in that they keep acting out the same behavior that's reflective of their frame of mind. And this is kind of what I was speaking of before. So if you walk around and have the sense that you're not good enough, then you're going to be relating to people in such a way that's going to reflect back to you that you're not good enough. And so, or that, so that when we engage with each other and you come across the path of someone who is behaving in such a way that might evoke your programming and might cause you to respond to that person with a sense of disdain or hostility. Because sometimes, you know, these feelings get evoked in you, you don't quite know why. I think that it's a good practice, one of the practices that I do, is to not be reactive to that kind of thing. So if someone is in my environment and they're, if I'm experiencing their behavior in a way that feels negative is to not respond negatively to it. That's kind of what I'm saying. Because for two reasons. One, you know, you don't want to reflect back to them. But also, sometimes it takes a while to figure out if it's you or if it's them.
Sure.
You know, because sometimes a person could be being completely innocent, and in the back of your mind you're going, well, why did they do that? They're doing that because of this reason, and they don't respect me, and they don't like me, and they're not considerate of me, and I'm getting upset. And so you create all these stories and, you know, these backstories mm-hmm. to what's happening in front of you, mm-hmm. and then you come out of that backstory in such a way that can be create more conflict. And so I spend a lot of time really in my head going through, well, is it you? Is it me? Is it me? Is it you? Doesn't matter because I'm not responding to it. I'm not going to respond to this. And then eventually I'll work it out and figure it out. And you know, and then after I figured out, I was like, phew, I'm really glad I didn't say something because I would have made some kind of a fool of myself by responding to this based on how it made me feel. And then it just made me realize that we have all these triggers in ourselves that cause us to collide with each other as opposed to just be able to approach with an open heart and just in recognition of who we all are.
Certainly, I think it's always important to remember a person's humanity.
Yeah.
Always.
Always. No matter what.
No matter what.
I agree. And the humanity that most of us forget to recognize is the one that we see in the mirror.
That's right.
You know, we have to always recognize and acknowledge the divinity and the sacredness of our own being. And I think when we do more of that, we can begin to recognize the sacred nature of relationship and community and all those things. And I really long for the day when humanity is based on those kind of sacred relationships instead of, you know, different camps and ideologies. You know, we all have ideologies. My ideology is right. And get into fights over ideologies. But if we can move out of the head of ideology and into the realm of truth in our feelings, maybe we can do that. I don't know. It's an interesting thought. And I think it's important that we pay attention to it. And I'll remind all of you, the number here is 212-209-2900. I have some material to share with you this evening, and we will find it all and get it up for you. But in the meantime, let me play a little of Odetta for you, and then we'll be back. 212-209-2900.
Ding, dong, you go marching to the table. You see the same old thing, well, it's all on one table. Knife, a fork, and a pan. And if you say a thing about it, you're in trouble with the man. Let the midnight special shine. Midnight special, shine did you know? Oh, well, I know a boy, a apron, and the dress she wore, umbrella on her shoulder, piece of paper in her hand. She goes a walking to the car.
That was Odetta. And we're going to now play you a piece. It's on YouTube if you want to check it out. David Amram performing What a Wonderful World. And this was part of the tribute to Robert Knight. And for those of you... Whoops. Let's see if I can stop this other thing from going. And we can go to that. You could find it on YouTube. I just did. And you can find it as well. YouTube, David Amram, Robert Knight. You can search and find it. But we're going to play it for you. It's very sweet. Did you want to say anything about it, Paulette?
Well, we invited Mr. Amram to be part of the tribute, and he had some lovely words to impart to the crowd. And then he performed on Chinese flute, and then broke into a song about What a Wonderful World. And towards the end of it, you'll hear how he pays his special tribute to Robert and his lyrics.
Okay, so let's go.
Gracing us, and still gracing us with his spirit. And all of us being here together to think about that, regardless of what's on the news, it was, is, and always will be a wonderful world. Of the rainbow, corporate in the sky, reflecting on the faces of the people going by. I see friends shaking hands, saying, how do you do? Or what they're really saying is, I love you. I hear babies crying, I watch the world. They'll know much more than I'll ever know. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world. Yes, I think to myself, what a wonderful world.
David Amram, that was really very, very beautiful and very, very sweet part of the program. And we'll be bringing you more as soon as we are able to do that. We've got some of the audio. We'll be editing it and bringing you other segments as we move forward. So that was a lovely piece. I'm grateful that we had that to share. And, oh, I closed it before I had a chance to tell people. Do you want to tell people who actually recorded that?
This was recorded by Jennifer Hanagawa, and she was an audience member at the event.
All right. Yeah, so if there are any other audience members and you've recorded some of this, please do send us a link to it. because we want to compile all of the stuff, all of the material, and some of the, you know, all different perspectives, angles. I think it'll be great if you're able to do that. Anyway, the number here is 212-209-2900, and we were talking about the importance, and really, you know, I consider it to be like part of spiritual practice, is recognizing the sacredness and the divinity in all of us, all of our beings, even the ones that seem to be the most troublesome. At the core of who they are is the same as the core of who we are. And when we can come to a full recognition of that, that's truly when the world will change.
I agree. But I also think that even in recognizing that essence, you also have to be very aware of what your gut feelings tell you. Sometimes someone isn't ready for you to connect with them at that level.
Well, I don't think you can connect with most people at that level. I think it's mostly a connection that's made at the subconscious level and on the spiritual level. There are many beings in the world who are not thinking on that level. It doesn't change the fact that they have divinity at the core of them. Doesn't mean that you need to befriend them, but see, the way my understanding of how spirituality works is that we communicate on so many different levels. Language is just the smallest part of it.
I completely agree.
And when we, you know, and we can communicate with people on a level that doesn't involve, you know, a 10-year relationship, in the sense that smiling at someone on the street can have a significant impact on that person's day. And if enough people are engaging in that way, it could have an impact on a person. We could have an impact on each other on a much greater scale. And one of the reasons I was speaking of my experience on the train is because I understand that the energies that you are reflecting and radiating from you impact the people in your immediate environment. And so that, you know, because a lot of people who consider themselves to be light workers, it's kind of a very liberally used term in the spiritual community, to be a light worker.
What does that mean?
A light worker means that it's like having a commitment to spiritual practice. It's having a commitment to service to the divinity of all. And so it's the kind of calling that would have called or driven someone to be a nun or a priest or a monk, except most light workers don't like religion, so we end up being in real life just regular people but still have that strong commitment to spiritual work. And so I would in many circles be classified as a light worker, because what you're doing is you're using your physical vehicle to magnify and spread light in the world. And so, you know, and so as I do many of these practices, I recognize the impact that they have. And then, you know, because nobody is light all the time, you know, can manifest that in their emotions all the time. I've over the years seen the difference. So that if I'm really, really feeling, you know, down or blue or bummed out, I try not to really interact with people, because what happens is that energy of downness transfers. And the person I'm relating to is going to experience that as well. And so what I do is I always try to treat myself first. So let me figure out what's going on with me and why I'm in this state before I go out and interact with people in this state. Or if I'm walking around because I need to walk around in the world and I'm feeling really bummed out, I don't really like to share it, because not that, you know, unless it's a friend or an intimate, you know, friend or something, but I don't like to share it with the world, because what happens is that it draws that, it magnifies. So if you're feeling really down and the other person feels your energy, then they're going to go down. And then the next person will feel that energy, and then they'll go down. And so you end up with a whole field of people that are depressed, because energy is transferable. So what a light worker does is they purposely become like the lighthouse, you know, that stands up, you know, for ships in the night, and you just reflect the light. And so you notice a lighthouse, you know, the light flashes, it'll go light, then it goes dark, then it goes light, then it goes dark. Mm-hmm. So nobody can be light like that all the time. So as a human being, you have to recognize that you can be, you can magnify and you can radiate light, but you sometimes have to shut down and take care of yourself. And then when you're feeling strong, then you can open up and radiate light. But what the practice is to not contribute to the darkness in the world. And so what I've discovered is that, you know, it's sort of like, you know, that movie The Secret and The Power of Manifestation. We're really, if when we really learn how to understand our energy and how it flows into the world, we can see how significant an impact it makes. And so, for instance, as a person who does healing, I could heal a person, work on healing, which is really just being a conduit for divine energy. A person could be in front of me, or they could be on the other side of the world, and I could still connect with that person, because energy is very transferable. And when you combine it with intent, that means that you can have an impact. And so even just as you can, you know, through Reiki and other forms, send energy to people and pray. And they have studies that show that when people are praying and meditation, violence goes down. And so what a person who would consider themselves a light worker does is spend time every day doing that. So if when I recognize that there's a problem in the news, rather than get angry about it, I will send prayer to it, or I'll send, like I'm trying to heal a person, I'll try to heal a situation. And so it's difficult for one person to do, but if you have hundreds of people doing it, then it can have a different, make a difference. And so that's why sometimes, even though we can recognize that there's negativity in the world, you can actively work on it without involving yourself in the negativity by being willing to extend light into that situation. And so that's what a light worker does.
Thank you.
Yeah, and so, you know, very often, or, you know, even to heal the earth, so very often I'll be called into whatever consciousness, into meditation, which is a lot like prayer, except it's not prescribed, in which I will send light or healing energy into all of those wells that are being created through fracking, because that's really poisoning the earth. Extreme, it's more than any other pollution, it's poisoning the earth. Mm-hmm. And it's not just because they're digging into deep into the earth. It's not just because they're pulling out all of the oils that for the earth is actually blood. So when we're sucking oil out of the earth, it's like pulling out its blood. And also, it's the waste that's being put into the holes. So what they're doing is they're taking all the toxic waste from corporations and industry, and they're dumping into this deep holes into the earth, and it's poisoning the earth and will kill it if we don't stop. So I spend a lot of time, just like I would do Reiki on a person, doing Reiki on the earth.
Wow.
So
that's deep.
Yeah. So that it doesn't die of poetry, because when the earth dies, we die. You know, somehow that's not connecting in people's minds. So you can do things in many ways. You can do the active front, which I also endorse and engage in, which is, you know, like protesting, letter writing, boycotting companies that engage in it, trying to raise people's consciousness, you know, all the peaceful ways that needs to be done. And then there's the energy work that needs to be done to do the repair and the healing. And so I think it needs to happen from both ends to change the world. And so this is why, you know, I started with that question, because sometimes at this point I can't really tell if it's universal or if it's just because it's in the field of the radiance of light, if that makes any sense.
It makes sense.
Yeah. So I suspect that it's more what I'm experiencing is more a reflection of what I'm putting out as opposed to universal change. I don't know, but I suspect. But then I think universal change is also happening very slowly, it seems.
Yes, I I think that sometimes people, and I can only speak from experiences I have when I was much younger, and you were talking about the importance of realizing that communication is not always just verbal. Mm-hmm. And when I was younger, I traveled a lot, and I've been to countries where I just did not speak any of the language and had a ball, you know, communicating with people where we understood each other perfectly.
I've had that experience.
And we both laughed.
I've totally had that experience.
We both knew what the joke was, and
about.
It was hilarious, and it was just a sweet moment, and I'll never see the person again, but boy, do I remember that interaction.
That is so true. When you're interacting with people across language, you really can communicate a lot.
Absolutely.
A lot. And the languages are not that different, so that you could pick up little phrases here and there and get a gist of it. But most of the communication is not even language. It's not. And that's why, you know, once we allow our awareness to go there, then we can communicate more successfully as human beings.
Yes.
Because it will require more honesty, I think. Because, you know, a lot of times one of the reasons relationships go sour is because one person is picking up, you know, the subtleties, and another person is not picking up the subtleties. And there's a communication barrier or something going on, in the sense that it's easy for people to be able to deny what they're sharing if it's a subtlety. So if, like, you might be in a relationship with someone and then you might feel, wow, this guy is not respecting me, but he's not saying anything. So it goes into a deeper level. Or a man might get into a relationship and feel like, well, this woman just doesn't really love me. She's not taking care of me. You know, so all of these feelings start evolving out of a situation in which the communication is not honest. And it's not honest not because people are not attempting to deceive each other. They're just not recognizing the vastness of the subtlety of communication. So you could be doing what you always do and don't realize you're hurting somebody else's feelings.
And one of the things that I think I've discovered over time as I've hopefully matured is that when I look at what I think is a successful relationship in a romantic sense, it's each person understanding exactly how the other person wants to be loved and doing whatever it takes for that person, the other person, to feel that love. And it takes a while to evolve to understand how the other person wants to be appreciated.
Well, I think that there's a lot of validity in that.
Is that
as long as it works for you?
But that's it.
It has to also work for you.
That's why it's each person. So if you if you're with someone and they understand how you want to be loved, exactly how you want to be loved, and then they go and do it, you know, take the extra time and know you well enough, and it's reciprocal. And when you understand exactly how they want to be loved, and you have this sort of harmony, it's a beautiful thing.
I could see that. I think that there's a lot of truth to that. I think on some level also you just have to be, you know, I guess I'm just processing it because I never really thought of it that way. But I understand that in the sense that love on a lot of levels is unconditional. And in the sense that you're right, you need to understand how a person wants to be loved. But I think it's also important to accept how a person is. Now, see, I wouldn't have translated it as how they want to be loved, but accept who they are. And whatever that is,
certainly
unconditionally, to me, is how I would translate how a person wants to be loved, is to be accepted for who they are. And so I'm looking at the acceptance for who they are part and incorporating what you're saying about finding out how a person wants to be loved.
I think it you have to have that acceptance factor. That's an integral part of this. And that goes into the mixture of taking someone as they are. I mean, you can take someone as they are and not necessarily have any romantic notions about them, but the aspect of it when you become more of a unit, that sense of understanding exactly what makes someone feel loved. And how you feel loved, and communicating that, and someone caring enough to actually do
pay
whatever.
Attention.
Absolutely.
To it. I mean, even if they can't do it, to acknowledge it and to communicate around those issues,
yes,
are part of what's really significant, no matter what kind of relationship it is, whether it's romantic or not.
Yes.
Those it's significant. In order to have successful relationships, to really, you know, to be, I guess tender is the word, you know, to just be tender about relationships and understand that, you know, we're all human beings, we're all feeling the same kinds of things and needing, desiring that sense of love is, you know, what everybody wants.
Mm-hmm.
And I you know, and that's on one level, that is what we can do for each other in our relationships, is to provide that love that we all crave. And the other part of that, I believe, is to find the answer to that craving from divine connection. I think also a part of what can happen is that people can become very needy and very dependent on each other. There's an up and a downside to all these things. And so I think if coming to a relationship in which each person is very strong within themselves is the ideal situation.
Yes.
Where you can feel like it's like two people standing up, not one person leaning against each other.
Yes.
To me is the ideal situation.
Yes, when you're your own person.
Yeah. We're getting, what time is it? 1:10. Okay. It's 10 minutes after the hour. And so we have a few minutes, at least 15 minutes, should you want to join this impromptu conversation. I also want to let you know that I do these meditation classes. I keep forgetting to announce when I'm sitting there with one person. two people when it could be more of you joining me if you would choose to in Brooklyn. The meditation classes are, and they're based on Qigong training and philosophy. It's sitting meditation, moving meditation, and sometimes we have discussions and tea as well.
It's nice.
It's not. It is nice, actually. And it's a healing space that I have been blessed with in Brooklyn on Bay Ridge, 110 Bay Ridge Avenue. And as it happens, I have a class this coming Sunday from 1 to 2:30. And the following week will be Saturday. So it is the first and third Saturdays, the second and fourth Sundays from 1 to 2:30. And if you want to find out more, you can go to the website qigongonline.net. That's Qigong Online. Qigong is spelled with a Q rather than how it sounds. qigongonline.net. Or you can go to heartofmindradio.com and click on to information there. And so at least this way, for those of you who want to go deeper into your spiritual practice or are interested in doing Qigong, and Qigong is actually like Tai Chi, only it's not martial arts. It's more connected to Taoism, Buddhism, and traditional Chinese medicine. So it's about, instead of moving energy around you, pushing and pulling, it's about moving the energy through your meridians and expanding the fields within so that you can be healthy, strong, and vibrant in your life. It's a great practice. It's why I'm able to be here, I think. It's made a significant difference for me to be an old gal in an old world.
Me too.
So, you know, that energy work really helps. And 212-209-2900 is the number. Should you want to tell us your perspective on sharing light and relationships and healing the discomfort that has grown over millennia between human beings, between men and women. I just think it's important to, because we can really only do what we can do. But if everyone chose to do something, that would be a lot. And so that's why I tend to look at things from the perspective of the individual and what the individual can do. 212-209-2900. Well, I guess we're so fascinating that people get to
okay.
And they're calling. They're like, well, they don't seem to need calls. They're just going on and on. Let's play a piece of music and see what happens. Okay. Let's maybe wake people up.
So close, there was
right. That was really a sweet song. We do have a caller standing by. And hello, you're
hello.
On the air. Yes.
All right. Well, I'm glad I was able to hear that song. That was that's a nice song.
Yeah.
You know, that brings back brings back to the 60s. Like the 60s, late 60s, early 70s.
Yeah. When, Candles in the Rain, Lay Down.
Right. Oh yeah. Who's that artist again? I forget.
Candles in the Rain.
Yes, and the artist?
Melanie Safka.
Melanie
Safka.
Right. It's got like a beat. This is Professor Rhythm anyway. That's got like a real beat to it. It's like almost like a hip hop beat. It's almost like rap beat. You know?
Sure. It's got soul.
And the way she belts that song out, it's like beautiful.
Mm.
Anyway, I wanted to chime in about relationships and imagination is really a great thing. You know, because. You can just use it to do anything. Especially if you just remember that, you're a child at heart as well as an adult. You have everything in you, all the different ages. So you can go back to using your imagination like a child in any place that you want that's in your life.
Uh-huh.
And so like, I often try to imagine that I'm from a planet where everything is together. They straightened out all their problems out. They were like, yeah, man, and now they're like observing the universe, and they focus on Earth, and they say, what is wrong with these people? You mean to tell me that like these people with this shade don't like this people with this shade, or think that they're better than these people with this shade? And then the women are saying that the men do this, and the men are saying that the women do this, and then they're not even like controlling their environment, and they're not even controlling their population. I mean, they're just not doing anything. And they're all thinking these different ways of like how mm-hmm. And they're all like getting angry at each other, because of like as you even right there, because of ideology. They say, no, no, it's not like this, it's not like that. And they're all getting angry at each other because of ideologies. And then they look they say, okay, let's focus on, like, okay, let's look at the psychiatrists. What do they call this? Oh, yeah, they call this, like, psychosis. Oh, I guess these guys all got a mass psychosis,
Mm-hmm.
just like, okay. And then beings like me being one of them, the beings on the other planet, you shrug the shoulders, yeah, okay, well, I guess they'll straighten it out, Seems kind of silly to me, but, they say look like they have the capacity to straighten all of this stuff out. You know, they seem kind of smart. They got all kind of technological things going for them, so, but I don't know, these are the other things,
I think most human beings have the capacity to straighten things out, and I believe that most human beings desire an end to the chaos and the madness and the suffering on the planet. I think it's, there's a small percentage of human beings that have profited from the suffering, and mm-hmm. And we have to stop cooperating with them. By mm-hmm. buying their products, we have to stop. There are a lot of nonviolent ways that we can take back the power of our humanity.
Right, and get out of the psychosis because to me and for the people on that planet that I hang out at sometimes, my imagination,
mm-hmm.
like, it's all a bunch of excuses, It really is, It's mm-hmm. like, you're making excuses for why you're not doing it, why you're not getting it together, People are doing it. Getting back to Earth, I realize that as human, we have a society that's grown up in a certain that has developed rather in a certain way that has come from something into something. If you're talking about the human kingdom, as the next kingdom above the animals and
maybe. Unfortunately, we're running out of time. That's the only reason I'm breaking in.
All right.
But thank you so much for calling, and call again, because I wish we had time to have that conversation, because I don't actually think human beings evolved in the way that the storybooks tell us.
Oh, no, I'm not even saying that. So we'll have that discussion because I'm definitely not saying that.
Okay. Yeah, no. Yeah, because I think that we're star beings. We're genetically engineered, actually.
I'm just talking about the monad. I probably heard of that. That comes through all of the different phases before it gets to the human plane. That's all I was saying.
Oh, okay. All right. Yeah, I was going to say. Well, no, you know, I have very alternate views about many things. So, yeah, we have to get into that discussion. So even though we are running out of time, we'll come back to it. Thank you for your call.
Yeah, okay. I had a nice time talking with you. Bye.
All right, bye-bye. Sadly, we have all these folks calling in now and no time. Well, maybe we could do rapid fire if you can hold it down to 1 or 2 minutes. Hello, you're on the air.
Hello?
Yes. Turn off your radio, please.
Okay.
Turn off your radio, please. Okay, hello? Okay, no, that's not going to work. Hello? Okay, good. Take care of that problem. No calls. Let me find some music so we can transition to our upcoming program, Hour of the Wolf with Jim Freund. You won't want to miss that. And let's see, why don't we play what, Liberation?
Or Earth Driver Say It Loud.
Oh, did I turn? Is your mic on? Yeah. Earth Driver. All right, let's play Earth Driver. One of the best bands in New York, certainly. Maybe the world. so we are making our transition in just a moment. And so I'm inviting Jim to say hello.
Hello.
Yes, and for Catherine and Paulette, we will be back with you again on Wednesday of next week. So stay tuned for Hour of the Wolf.
Good morning. This is Hour of the Wolf, a weekly program generally about science fiction, fantasy, enchantment, and the imagination. Well, we're going to deal a bit more with the latter two this morning. Sad to say, it's another obituary show. This one dedicated to the talent of Stan Freeberg. Stay tuned.
Dan Persons, movie reviewer for Hour of the Wolf. Full disclosure, I am thanked by name during the closing credits of cartoonist Bill Plimpton's new film, Cheatin'. came as a complete surprise to me and a pleasant one. But the reason for it is that I saw the film early on, really liked it, and made some modest efforts to help it find a distributor. Not sure how much I actually helped, but I guess it was enough to get a little shout-out during the credit roll, so that's nice. Bottom line, for the sake of this review, is that I liked the film first, then helped, then got thanked. So nothing about this review is going to be the tail wagging the dog. I come to it clean. And yes, Cheatin' is a really good film. Bill Plimpton, who's best remembered for such classic animated shorts as 25 Ways to Quit Smoking and one of my favorites, One of Those Days, had a breakthrough with his last feature film, Idiots and Angels. There, he decided to jettison dialogue completely and let his distinctive artwork based on rough pencil-style outlines and caricatures that occupy a dimensionally curved reality that's like everything run through a fisheye lens. He let that do the talking, and it was the best decision he could ever make. He carries forward on that with Cheatin', no G, an apostrophe at the end, in which a newlywed couple has their idyllic marriage sorely tested when a photograph rigged by a jealous prospective lover lures the husband away from his vows. Interesting thing about Bill Plimpton, he's known for his, for want of a better term, edgy humor. I don't really like that word, but it's the only one I can call on at the moment. He earns that rep. His characters are brilliantly surreal and malleable. Limbs can stretch as needed, and bodies can twist into all varieties of impossible forms, and the universe they occupy is frequently filled with raunchiness, violence, and disasters man-made, natural, and at times supernatural. But he doesn't really plunge into the darkest depths. It's more the curdled romanticism of James M. Cain than the aggressive assaults of a Michael O'Donohue. For all the wild hyperbole of Cheatin's imagery, one brilliant sequence has an overhead survey of the couple's home the morning after their wedding night, a full-on coital disaster zone that includes a car crashed through the wall, a renegade vibrator, a clown mask, and a flounder. And despite the similarly hyperbolic plot, eventually a homicidal thug, a disgraced magician, and his mind transfer machine get dragged into the scenario. What's wonderful is that Plimpton has discovered that anarchy and empathy are not at odds with each other. In the quasi-post-war world of Cheatin', where seaside amusement piers can still be healthy profit centers, gas costs 40 cents a gallon, and there's nary a television in sight, romantic love and sexual abandon can dwell hand in hand, and when a couple's estrangement gets literalized by showing their marriage bed fracturing in two to float the wayward husband away, the heartbreak is quite real. Bill Plimpton has always been a singular talent. He still does all the animation himself, and it's amazing how one pen can choreograph distinct personalities into each character. With Cheatin', he confirms that he's become a hell of a storyteller as well. I'm Dan Persons. Remember, we are archiving these reviews over at my Mighty Movie Podcast website, so check out what you missed by going to Mighty Movie Podcast.
Thank you. And now we'd like to...
Mr. Feeberg?
Yes, who are you?
I'm Marianne Feemster. I'm 10 years old. I've been sitting in the audience.
Yes?
I've been thinking over what you said about how you're doing this because there aren't any more radio programs.
Yes?
Mr. Feeberg, what's a radio program?
Well, when you listen to the radio in the morning, what do you hear?
Disc jockeys and news, or sometimes news and disc jockeys. Is it possible to hear something else?
It was back in the 1940s, yes.
Back in the olden days?
Yes, there were what we call radio programs, like what we're doing here with actors and live musicians and sound effects men and guest stars.
Oh, you mean like a television program when the picture tube blows out?
Something like that, yes.
What did you look at?
He didn't look at anything. He just listened.
Boy, talk about your radical ideas.
Look, dear, you're just too young to remember, I guess. I'll have someone from the audience explain it. Anybody here remember radio? And anybody? Anybody at all?
I do.
Oh, good. Good. Here's a lady. Here's a lady. Come right up here, madam. Watch your step, dear. Yeah. You do remember radio programs, do you?
Oh, yes, yes. I remember them.
You used to listen to them, did you?
I did as a girl, yes. My goodness, yes.
For the benefit of this young lady, could you tell us what it was like?
Well, it was, no, dear, I'm trying to remember.
Just take your time.
Well, if my memory serves me correct, we'd hurry to get the dishes done, and we'd all sit around the living room listening to the,
radio.
Radio, that's it.
Hi, Romeo. What did you look at while the radio was on?
Oh, we looked at each other. Kind of stared off into space while Inner Sanctum was on. The Whistler, the Shadow.
Huh?
The weed of crime bears bitter fruit. Do you know who said that?
Who?
Lamont Cranston, that's who. Compared to him, my dear, James Bond is a fink.
But I still don't know what you used for pictures.
You used your imagination.
Your what?
Look, you could do things on radio, see, that you couldn't possibly do on television. My sound effects man and I will give you a demonstration right now.
Okay.
Okay, people, now, when I give you the cue, I want the 500-foot mountain of whipped cream to be shoved into Lake Michigan, which has been drained and filled with hot chocolate. Then the Royal Canadian Air Force will appear overhead towing a 10-ton maraschino cherry, which will be dropped into the whipped cream to the cheering of 25,000 extras. All right, cue the mountain. Cue the Air Force. Okay, 25,000 cheering extras. Now, you want to try that on television?
I see what you mean.
Stan Freberg was an utter genius. He was subversive, although subversive in what way, I'm not sure I can say. Just in anything that he cared for. What he cared for was radio, as you just heard from his album Freeburg Underground. He cared for voices. He knew his voices. He was many, many voices. You're saying, who's Stan Freeburg? He was Cecil, the C6C serpent. He produced many of the commercials, TV commercials, that you may remember when you were young. He took over Jack Benny's radio slot. And you will hear on Max Schmid's Golden Age of Radio and any shows Max will be doing in the next week. Look at your program guide at WBAI.com.